Hello, and welcome to Scaling Justice, where we look to peel back some of the layers of our justice system with really a goal of better understanding its many dimensions and the impact that it has on all of us, whether we're practitioners or technologists or even community members who are looking to make a difference in justice. I'm your host, Sue Humphries, and I've spent the last 30-some years working right at that intersection of technology and justice. And along the way, I've had the good fortune to meet some very amazing people, really at all levels of the justice system. And the truth is, I've found that while our justice system isn't perfect by any stretch, there is a lot of good work happening all across this country. And on this podcast, we're bringing some of that forward to share with you. On each episode, we highlight different aspects of the challenges that are confronted by the justice system, and we talk about some of that work that's happening in various agencies with the intent that there's something we all can be doing to help improve the flow of justice for everybody who's wrapped up in it. Today, we're diving deeper still into the world of public safety and justice data, where it's housed, how it's being used, and the steps we're taking to ensure that it is continually driving us forward in a way that's meaningful and helps to inform decisions and ultimately helps governmental agencies ensure fairness and equitable outcomes for everyone that travels through it. Our guest today is Paul Wormeley. And Paul is the co-creator and very first-time executive director of what is known as the IJIS Institute. If you're not familiar with IJIS, it's a nonprofit that brings the private and public sectors together to improve information sharing across justice-related agencies. It's really one of the very first organizations of its kind that has successfully figured out how to break down those barriers that tend to exist between technologists and public safety and justice practitioners. Paul is literally responsible for getting the right people in the same room to tackle many of the big challenges that are just inherent in working with and understanding and moving data that feeds our justice system.
The way we've organized the whole criminal justice system is we've created different components of it in this adversarial system that believe that their individual component is the source of all knowledge and wisdom, and that they distrust each other.
Paul has spearheaded a host of innovative programs in public policy. In fact, he's been called on by our White House several times as an advisor and drafter of federal law on things like security and privacy. He's been an expert on standards and goals for criminal justice, and he was appointed by the president and confirmed by the U.S. Senate as deputy administrator of the LEAA, which is the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration under the U.S. Department of Justice.
It's fundamentally a part of our constitutional obligation to protect the privacy and civil liberties of our citizens.
Needless to say, Paul is an innovator, he's an entrepreneur, he's an in-demand consultant, and he's focused his entire career on the application of information technology. And I could not be happier than to have him on today's program.
I'm delighted to be with you, and this is a critical time to talk about these issues and engage as many people as possible in understanding the premises that will lead us to improving the quality of justice in America.
I think you are absolutely dead on, so I appreciate having you part of that conversation. I know when I started, I probably lopped off some of your extensive resume. Is there anything else you'd want to share about just where you've been or your experience in this wild, wild world of information sharing?
One of the things I got involved with early on that still to this day represents a powerful force in the justice field is the origination of what was originally called Project Search, now the Search Group Incorporated, which is really a consortium of all the states coming together to figure out how to apply advanced technology to improving justice information technology in particular. And that was a project that we started in 1969 that was under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Justice to create a prototype for exchanging computerized criminal history records across the states. And it was kind of one of the first major national efforts in real information sharing that was fostered by the federal government and kind of started us down this road of figuring out how to share information, at least across the elements of the justice system.
So let's back up on that just for a minute, because I was just at this winter meeting of CERCH, the symposium they had. And so sitting in that room with a lot of these state level directors and people who are wrapped around the criminal history information and those repositories, clearly they've come a long way. I mean, they seem to have a lot of the right systems in place. They're tackling these problems. I know many still exist, but can you give us some perspective on back from those early days and how that sort of has come together over the ensuing decades?
Yeah, it's really kind of an important model because it has a set of methodologies associated with it that I think are relevant to a lot of the problems we're trying to deal with today. But before CERCH came into being, there was no way that states could share with each other the rap sheet or the criminal history of people. What had to happen was when you arrested someone, you sent fingerprints to the FBI, and 6 or 8 weeks later, they would come back with a rap sheet. But it was not very satisfying and not very useful to making decisions at the local level. We were asked to build a prototype to get initially 10 states and then ultimately all the states into a system that would allow for states to exchange data with each other using the FBI as an index to the state records. I remember briefing Director of the FBI, Hoover, on this prototype that we built and him saying, well, what's wrong with the U.S. mail? We could do this in 6 to 8 weeks and get this information out. And I told him with great trepidation that, you know, the courts don't like us to keep people in jail for 6 to 8 weeks waiting for an FBI rap sheet to show up. And we have to release them in 48 hours. And J. Edgar turned to me and said, well, that's very wonderful, but who made that decision? I said, well, the courts have said that, sir. And he said, well, then it's their problem, isn't it? So we had to jump through some hoops, but we really finally got Congress on board. And in the course of that, we dealt early on with some of the most important issues of privacy and security, and as well as integration of systems at the state and low level. We built a protocol for a common messaging system that I found out many years later became the basis for the internet protocol.
Wow.
Because there wasn't any messaging protocol in those days. CERCH also really started the whole movement towards automatic electronic fingerprint recognition systems, which is now commonplace. And it was a collaboration of state and local and federal agencies. The FBI was a participant and, you know, after a while, a very active participant, and the systems that were built created a national network for information sharing that really offers a lot to other agencies that are trying to do this even today. So we learned how to do it, and you know, the real success factor was to get the people together who represented the stakeholders, the real users of information, the people that needed the information, and get them to figure out how to make it happen and collaborate without letting the institutional obstacles get in the way. So it was a great experience.
That cannot have been an easy lift. As you talk about it, it sounds like, oh, well, that just all kind of came together. And I'm sure looking back, perhaps it did. But while you were in it, just getting those people to the table, that's a huge accomplishment, even in today's world where, even for myself, I'm in and out of some of these agencies, and we still find that just getting people to talk with one another from law enforcement, from prosecution, from the courts, into corrections, that is not simple sometimes due to different missions and policies.
Right.
Give us some framework or some idea of how far maybe we've come in that regard.
Well, we have come very far, actually, and the big obstacles were never really technical. They're cultural.
Right.
The way we've organized the whole criminal justice system is we've created different components of it in this adversarial system we've created that believe that their individual component is the source of all knowledge and wisdom. and that they distrust each other. Some of that is the nature of the system, but some of it is just the natural bureaucratic construction of these agencies, which makes people proud of what they're doing, but it also makes them feel superior to anyone who's not in their agency or discipline. So then there's this issue of trust, and how do we trust people to use the data that we might share with them? There's also an issue of control. There used to be a generally accepted notion that all knowledge is related to control, and if I give you any of my knowledge, then I lose control. Mm. Over the years, we've challenged that fundamental premise. I say we, I'm talking about the whole country, has gotten, I think, engaged in this. To think that we are stewards of the data we collect. We are not the owner. And that, you know, our, as the director of national intelligence a few years ago said in a memo to all of the intelligence analysts, you know, your job is to make your data discoverable, not to hoard it. We've moved to that direction, I think, pretty well throughout the country, where now within even police organizations, like, you know, it's still true that there's some animosity between police chiefs and sheriffs in counties, and they have learned that they have to work together. And people in the criminal justice system have looked at, you know, how do we really collaborate on the process of criminal justices across the point of arrest, point of prosecution, the point of adjudication, the point of community supervision. And people are realizing that collaboration is the key, and if you're going to, once you get to that point, it's a pretty easy reach to say information sharing is the key.
Yeah,
I think we've really made great progress in getting that cultural change to happen. So now that there are criminal justice coordinating councils all over the country, where all of the elements of criminal justice come together in major cities, I've been fortunate to do some work for some of those, including the Metro Washington, D.C. Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. And they're very effective at realizing that no one owns the answer to all the problems that we face in criminal justice. And in order to solve some of these terrible problems facing us, like the opioid crisis, we have to work not only with other components of the justice system, but other governmental entities like social services and healthcare. And we have to figure out ways to overcome the obstacles of institutional barriers. Bill Bratton wrote a book a couple of years ago with a fellow from Harvard called Collaborate or Perish. He really laid it all out in very concrete terms of any agency that's not working towards a better level of collaboration is on its way to dying, or at least getting unfunded.
You bring up that CJCC, and I completely concur that where we see those collaborative councils in place, we absolutely are seeing, you know, more progress and in many ways inside a jurisdiction. What's your take on why we aren't seeing those in every jurisdiction?
Well, I think some of it is money. Some of it is there's not ways to fund the interactive work. If people are given funding for their own agency, but no funding for the common good, so to speak, whether it's convening, you know, or figuring out how to build an integrated justice information system. We've made progress in that in larger counties and cities around the country, but medium-sized cities and counties still really don't have the benefit of that kind of level of effort. Some of it's that, you know, I only have a limited amount of funds and I'm understaffed and overworked and underpaid, and I can't even do my own job, so why in the heck should I get involved with your job? People are not motivated by it all over the country like they ought to be. We know that it saves money, it saves time, and has tremendous productive outcomes when you are able to do that. There's plenty of examples around the country of just superb work. And one of the things we don't realize, and people, legislators and funding authorities don't realize, is how much unbelievable duplication of effort there is in data entry and in data collection process. There are still cities around this great land of ours that have a separate police department that enters all the data on an arrestee and then prints out a piece of paper to take it to the prosecutor, who re-enters all the data in their system and then creates a filing, takes it to the court, who re-enters all the data in their system. So by the time you're done, you've entered the name, address, sex, weight, height, hair, eyes, et cetera, of the offender about 25 times before you even get to trial.
Yeah, we absolutely run into that all the time at Equivant, where we're doing work with these agencies, and it's then trying to mash that data up and make sense of it, you know, tracking it properly from the original source all the way through. It can be quite complex when you don't just have a source that is pushing it along upstream, right, all the time, which seems to be the more sensible way to be doing it. So you mentioned funding. Is that, you think, a big part of that, or is it aversion to adopting newer technologies?
There's no simple answer to that question. It's both and more. Funding is not anywhere what it needs to be for integrated justice and information sharing. We haven't made the business case well. You know, one of the problems in the criminal justice world, and assuming a number of your listeners probably work in this world, one of the problems is that we're good about talking to each other, but we're not good at talking to the public or the legislature or the rest of the world to justify the kind of investment that can be justified. I think the business case can be made very dramatically for how improving information sharing, and I'm really kind of lately more talking about knowledge sharing than just information sharing. It's not just a collection of data. It's, you know, what each step in the process needs is knowledge about what happened in the prior step. And if we're able to focus on that, that's how this loosely coupled set of processes we call a system works. It's not a system in the engineering sense of that word. It's a set of processes that rely on each other for their success.
I love the way you've said that, and really that transformation from data, you know, kind of bits and bytes to knowledge, because I share that idea that data is great. It is kind of at the root of what you're doing, but unless you can transform that into information that people can consume and it enhances their understanding, you know, I'm not sure that you're doing all you can do. It's that we, as humans, we're looking for that information, right?
Yeah, and we really want to go even beyond knowledge towards wisdom.
There you go.
We want to use the data to make us wiser so we make better decisions. And as you know, the criminal justice system is a set of discretionary processes that are linked together. So we have to empower the decision makers to use that discretion to make the best possible decisions. And you do that by informing them of all of the factors that go into making a valid decision.
That's an interesting thing to talk about for a second, because, you know, there's been a lot of blemish on tools like risk assessments, whether there is systemic bias being perpetuated through them, replacing human judgment, and that they're just telling a justice worker what to do as opposed to informing them of certain aspects of something and just helping them make a more informed decision. What's your personal take on that?
I think we absolutely have to figure out ways to make those decision makers better informed. I'm not a believer that you could automate the process of determining individual risk or making decisions on that without a human element, because there's too many factors that are not documented. All the human factors that go into a decision are never going to be replaced by a computer, in my mind. The problem that you're addressing, though, is that we've built a lot of algorithms for risk assessments that are not based on an appropriate database. We've seen that over and over again, where a set of data that's used to build an algorithm, and we face this now in machine learning all over the place, is based on a limited, biased set of data, so that the algorithm becomes formed based on that limited biases. You know, if you build a machine learning system with data about a bunch of older white guys, you're never going to make it useful in dealing with decisions related to young black males. And we've made some serious mistakes in that area, but we've discovered those mistakes. And a lot of people are now trying to come up with realistic ways to ensure that the quality of the knowledge that's presented to a decision maker is based on an adequate sample and a realistic representation of the population serve. We still need the automation of it. There's a judge you probably know about out in Oregon that did some pioneering work several years ago about looking at all the different sentences that could be applied to a given cohort and looking at the probability of success of those various 20 different sentencing policies as a function of the cohort of people that it had been applied to and trying to really create evidence of what works. And then use that in the court's decision making. He didn't let the computer make the decision, but he took that advice from the data, the evidence of what has worked in the past, to tailor his decisions. And he got a lot of pushback from other judges who say, well, you can't use data. It's just too human an element. But then if you don't try to improve the quality of that evidence and that decision-making support, you end up with the disparities in justice that we've seen over the years from wildly different sentencing outcomes for this exact same type of crime based on the county you live in as opposed to anything that has to do with the elements of the case. But one of the things that all of this has done over the years, I think, has made the most progress is that we realized even 50 years ago when we were starting to address these things that it was absolutely essential that we come up with some way to create standards for decision-making and processing people and collecting the data so that we could add together the data that's out there and use it to provide better evidence that supports better decision-making. And so in the standards area, we've come a long, long way. But we've gone beyond that now. We started 20 years ago when we started the IJIS Institute. We wrote this sort of basic paper on using a thing like XML, extensible markup language, to be able to have a common vocabulary of data elements. And then that was support from the U.S. Department of Justice that merged into the whole idea of the National Information Exchange Model, NIEM, which has now been adopted for some purpose in just about every state and 2/3 of the federal agencies. So that creates a framework for developing standards for exchanging data, which cuts the cost in half and makes it faster and easier to build these kinds of exchanges.
So one of the things that came up at CERCH is that while all of this data is being collected and it's all being moved, somewhere, there's still this big disconnect happening somewhere at that criminal history repository where we've got arrest records that are not necessarily connecting back up with dispositions, especially. What do you think is the thing that we could be doing to really tackle that issue? Or do you even see that as an actual big issue?
Oh, I think it's a huge issue. I've been on the track of promoting this idea for 50 years now, and it's disgusting to me that 2/3 of the records in the criminal history repository are incomplete. I actually helped write the law back in 1972 that required disposition data, and we have solid evidence of the damaging effect of that. There's been a number of studies of how many people are unable to get a job because there's a partial record of their involvement in the criminal justice system with no disposition data. So there's huge reasons why we need to solve this problem, all kinds of reasons, and we need to work on it. I will tell you that the FBI is doing a massive job themselves trying to fix that problem of the completeness of records to the point of going out to the states and local courts and getting disposition data, and they're making a lot of progress on it. Some states are, but there's still a number of states who just haven't stepped up like they need to, and somehow I think we need to give them some kind of incentive, even if it's shaming them into participating in the proper way. The question is, where do you get the data that you need to solve this problem? I was invited by the chief of the Supreme Court in Louisiana to help them figure out how to recover from Katrina and the justice system there. And I discovered that the courts in Louisiana have no interest in providing disposition data. They let the Supreme Court create some output to give to the state police, to give to the FBI. But there were so many problems with the inconsistency of the data that nothing got reported.
Wow.
There was literally no disposition data going from that whole state to the courts, and nobody wanted to solve the problem.
So what did you do?
I told the Chief Justice at the time that, you know, what I had found, and she was amazed, and she finally got some people in the room to start figuring out how they could not be embarrassed by this. But sometimes you just have to say the embarrassing things out front in public, and that sometimes motivates people to solve the problem.
Where else have you seen that aha moment, I guess, where an entire government like that understands the implications? And I'm guessing there's some moment where they just get it through tutelage of people like you. I'm curious on two levels. One is, do you have any other anecdotal kind of experiences along that line? And then also, what can people like us here at Equivant or other companies, are there things that we can be doing in our work with these agencies to help with this problem?
Well, let me answer that one first, and then I'll come back to the examples of it, because I think you're raising a very important question. That the people that provide software and services to this field have as much a responsibility, in my mind, as the practitioners themselves in improving the quality of justice for many, many reasons, and not just their own economic well-being. The extent to which you help solve the social problem is more and more companies are realizing that they're not just in business for making pure profits of the shareholders. They're part of this community that owes something to their participation in the community. And companies need to do this, not just to be good guys, but because it benefits them in the long run. And there's two reasons for that. Just to be blunt about it, companies can help build the market for more investments, which is to their own benefit. And they can also create greater opportunities for them to participate in more developing solutions. And I think, that's something that we need to foster and make clear to people. And that's one of the things that I just tries to do, is to bring people together to talk about the problems, as you said in your introduction, and help expand the opportunities for companies, but also work towards more effective deliverables. That's really an important thing to do. And I think the specific thing you can do when you ask a question like you did is help the practitioner world build the business case and then help them make the business case to the people who have the dollars to make decisions that are useful. Companies need to be looking at their own products in terms of the value premise that they present to society. If you're going to propose a solution, if you're a government entity and propose a solution for any problem, you ought to be able to express it in terms that your mother would understand. Why that tax dollar is being spent that way. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that very much in the justice world. The companies that I've started and run for years were equally guilty of this. We focus on the technology and on the internal consistencies. And often we talk about outputs rather than outcomes excessively. We want to solve the problems of the opioid crisis. We want to solve the problems of excessive recidivism. There's still, in many places in this country, we have 80% recidivism rates. That's unacceptable. We do know ways to reduce that, but we don't make the case to the local board of supervisors or the city council or the state legislature about what it's going to take to do that. And we need to help make that business case and talk less about the technology for doing more about what are you trying to accomplish.
Well, you're right. We get caught up in that features list, and
these
1,000 little bits of features, but don't help those practitioners understand how those features come together to actually do something meaningful for them.
Exactly. I used to brag about some of our software in my early days as one of the first systems to include a master name index. It was really cool. But you talk to an average citizen, well, what good does that do me?
Yeah.
Why is that important?
No, that's a good point.
As far as your first question, there's been some really outstanding, particularly local issues, like county level issues. I'm thinking about in Maricopa County, Arizona, did a amazing set of integrations of data flow where police arrests were automated, captured, and supplied to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor added to the data that was already captured by the police and then presented the filings to the court based by just adding prosecutorial scheduling and docketing information that the court was able to suck that data in. Never a bit of redundant data entry, and that full record was then available to the jail. And they were working, the last I knew, on, you know, making all that work with the state level. So there's just pockets of that around the country that are really, really impressive. And people are more and more getting into that whole thing. San Diego has done a lot of great things with the ARGIS system to integrate across 50 different agencies that they deal with. There are consolidations now of systems. Smaller police agencies are coming together to fund a centralized records system that serves 10 or 20 different agencies. We're finding ways to do that and save money and save time and improve productivity.
So from a technology perspective, recognizing just that inherent need for the flow of that information as it travels through, but also doing that efficiently, yeah, securely, so that everybody is confident, right, that their data is not just out there being shared wantonly. Those are good challenges for technologists, for sure.
We have still miles to go before we sleep, but we've made enormous steps forward.
Paul, I want to shift to a related topic, a little bit different. I know you've written some articles around this as well, but let's talk for a minute about the advent of newer technologies that are introducing volumes and volumes of data into the system. So, you know, yeah, things like body-worn cameras and, you know, the popular Ring system, self-driving cars, whatever those things are. Where are you seeing that, and what are some of the implications of that massive amounts of data we now also have access to?
First of all, we're introducing technology at a rate that our legal system cannot yet deal with. I gave a speech to Congress 2 years ago and basically told them that they're obsolete because they can't pass laws fast enough to deal with this fast changing pace of technology. And they haven't. And they start dealing with laws about a particular technology, and by the time they finish their deliberations, that technology is obsolete and we're on to the next thing. There needs to be a new national thinking about policy for the use of technology that reflects the principles, the basic privacy principles that were agreed upon in the 50s about, you know, what data you need to collect, how do you control secondary dissemination. We need to, as a country, develop those policies so that whatever the technology is, we'll live with them. And we haven't done that. We don't have national policies on body-worn cameras or automated license plate readers or, you know, and the thousands of different implementations of artificial intelligence and machine learning that are sure to come soon. We need a policy framework that takes into account the protection of privacy and civil liberties in the face of rapidly emerging, and changing technology. There are serious problems with the basis for this technology. Cities around the country are denying the police the use of facial recognition, even though it's a fantastic tool for many specific police applications, but because there's no good policy about it. So San Francisco and Oakland banned it. You know, and I think New York State's considering banning it. So that technology is not useful to law enforcement and justice because of the failure to have a policy governing the control of the data that it generates. And it isn't about the technology, it's about the data, as your question really implies. We haven't developed the kinds of policies about secondary use of data that we should, no matter what the data is. And it controls the development of machine learning algorithms that are fraudulently based or based in biased data sets. We could do that if we put our mind to it as a country. We've dealt with these kinds of things before, but it's hard to get the legislative bodies to buy into the importance of this issue because it sounds so esoteric. But it's really a policy problem about the use of data, not about the technology. Mm-hmm. We have to figure this out somewhere or another. or by default, it'll just keep us from using the technologies in the right way and end up with a lot of implementations that are wrongheaded, which we've done that in the past, too.
Yeah, a lot of these are out there. They're right. Actively being used, and agencies are being forced to deal with the fact that they're in use. And so without those policies to support and guard that, then where are we at, do you think, in terms of being able to push more awareness at a national level about the importance of that policy setting?
Well, there's some glimmerings in Congress of people starting to pay attention to, for example, rewriting the Privacy Act of 1974 and all that it implies about privacy and civil liberties to take into account the advancements in technology. But I think there's a lot of people that realize it needs to happen. It's all really fundamentally a part of our constitutional obligation to protect the privacy and civil liberties of our citizens. So on the body-worn cameras, I just finished a study for Nashville, which is published on my website, about the criminal justice impact of body-worn cameras. Most cities and counties that have adopted body-worn cameras have do so particularly with the lens of what it does in the police department. But once you implement body-worn cameras, you generate a mountain of evidence, which has to be dealt with by the prosecutor in the courts and the public defender. An average police body-worn camera will generate 4 hours per shift of video. And in a city like Nashville, where you deploy 3,000 cameras, you've got 12,000 hours per day of video to look at. Mm-hmm. And they could, depending on their policies on how they implement it, they could end up needing a couple hundred attorneys to deal with this. And you can't just totally automate it. There's no software available that will really solve the problems of redaction and review. It takes people to look at it. So when cities get excited about body-worn cameras, which many of them do, because they think it'll reduce the excessive use of force by police, they don't realize what they're doing is creating an enormous workload for the criminal justice system and huge problems of privacy and civil liberties, which are under, you know, very stringent rules from the Supreme Court and the Constitution and state law. Anything that's done with technology in the law enforcement field has some impact on the criminal justice system, even if it's no more than the ability to present the evidence that's collected by that technology. So we have to work harder to have holistic views of how we're introducing technology and what has to be done in a way to support its intelligent and productive use, not just have it because it's the latest fad in town.
Right. Like we're not looking far enough downstream to what all those implications are, because those numbers you just cited are sobering. I did take the liberty of reading what you had on the article on the weight of evidence that does speak to a lot of these things that we've been talking to this afternoon. So wormeleconsulting.com is a great resource for people to look into some of these things that Paul has all these years of experience and wisdom that he's bringing to the table and sharing with us.
Thank you. My bottom line, and I kind of reflecting on what you were asking earlier, is I think there's a lot of hope that we are making progress and will make more progress to improve our ability to make substantive decisions in the administration of justice that will be fair and equitable and deal with the inequities and protect civil liberties. There are just too many people, as you said earlier, good people working in this field who care about these things and care about the impact of their work. And I'm really an optimist about how the future will develop in this field. So I want to thank you for having this conversation, because it's been a lot of fun and I'm always willing to talk about it.
I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day, Paul, to have the conversation. And I share your optimism. I think you're right on. We're moving in the right direction, maybe not as fast as we'd like to see it happen, but there are all kinds of considerations. So maybe fast isn't the answer, but, you know, thorough is the answer and thoughtful is more of the answer,
yes,
right?
Absolutely,
thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us and educating us on this topic. You're just a treasure trove of information, and I really appreciate what you've done to further the industry, and just could not be more grateful for the work you've done. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much to you, our audience, for listening in on this edition of Scaling Justice, brought to you by Equivant. Drop us a line at scalingjustice@equivant.com and weigh in on who you'd like to hear from or topics you'd like to explore. Until next time, I'm your host, Sue Humphries, and I look forward to scaling justice with you.